Welcome to the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections Oral History Project, where we record the oral histories of current and former DOC employees. I'm DOC Communications Director Susan McNaughton. This oral history focuses on memories from the October 1989 riot at the State Correctional Institution at Camp Hill. Our guest today, September 17th, 2019, is Mr. 2020, who is also known as John Wingert, back in 1989. Thank you for joining us, Mr. 2020.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Sue.
And I understand that while it's September 17th for me, it's actually September 18th for you.
Absolutely. Tell you, I live in Australia now, and I can tell you, since we're in the future, you're going to have a lovely day.
Thank you. So before we begin, could you please just provide me and our listeners with a brief overview of your DOC career?
Cool. I was a rookie at the time of the hostage or the time of the riot. I've been working for about 4 months for the Department of Corrections, and on the first day of the riot, they positioned me probably the furthest, crappiest role in the big yard on the Group 2 and 3 area, which probably kept me out of a lot of trouble, which was really nice.
Okay. So you jumped ahead just a little bit, so let me set the stage for
you.
All right. Now we'll get to the Camp Hill riot. It is around 2:30, 3 p.m. on Wednesday, October 25th, 1989. Where are you, and what's happening?
Cool. I was in, I just came on duty, I believe. Yeah, that was an afternoon shift. And they put me in the far part of the yard for Group 2 and 3. And I was way back by the fence where the inmates make deals, cut hair, that kind of thing, and just doing my job there. And it was time to bring the inmates back in. And I had a handful of inmates that were just mucking around. They wouldn't move. They were taking their time. And it was, as I was trying to basically get them moving and get them toward E-Gate, that I realized that there was a problem that there were some guards attacked, including a friend of mine named Alan. And it was then that I realized that the inmates were hanging back, trying to stay out of trouble, and maybe even keeping me out of the way of what was happening.
Hmm. And then what happened?
That day was pretty short for me. Whenever I got back up to the E-Gate area where the first commotion was, we did a little rescue where we had to go in and grab one of the hostages, or one of the guys that was getting beat pretty good in front of the kitchen. And we took him to the main gate, and it was somewhere around there where I was basically told to go to the hospital with an inmate. And that first night, basically, I just guarded an inmate at the local hospital until I went home, and then returned to work the following afternoon.
Okay. So afternoon the next day, the inmates watched the news around 6 o'clock, and this is after they had been locked in their cells and, everything was secured at the facility.
Right.
They watched the news, they're not happy, and then what happens? And where are you?
That's cool. At that point in time, I was working with another fellow named Ray, and we were working in K Block. That would have been the honor block at the time. And there was a commotion that happened at the block adjacent to there, and long story short, somehow Ray and I missed the evacuation order, and we tried to lock ourselves in the box, which was impossible, because the box was destroyed, and the inmates were able to let themselves out by reaching up and pulling on the control cables, because the panels were all ripped down from day one.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, once they started coming out in numbers, Ray and I made a run for it, and we both got caught in the courtyard between Group 3 and Group 2. Trying to head toward what was E-Gate.
Okay. And then what happened?
Wow. I got beat pretty good. taken to E-Block, and then for the rest of the night, basically transferred from one location to another as the night unfolded.
So were you blindfolded and handcuffed?
I was zip tied, man. Those suckers hurt.
Mm-hmm.
I was zip tied, and that was on too tight. They loosened those up a little bit somehow, but blindfolded, put a bag over my head, all that good stuff, and they actually even cooked a meal for me in the middle of the night, which was nice. I wouldn't eat it. You know, I told him I was hungry, just you know, trying to gain some rapport with the guys. But yeah.
Were some of them kind of trying to look out for you at all? I mean,
yeah, absolutely. There was a fella who we called Tiny. He was a big guy. I remember him from we were giving out coats one day, because obviously in October, September, October, it's heading in toward the winter. And it seems like Tiny had a role in getting information out, as well as keeping everybody safe in some way. I'm not really sure what all was going on there, but the fellows that kept me captured, I mean, they were decent. I mean, they explained to me, look, not only were we keeping you hostage, but we're also keeping you safe, which totally makes sense, because you have over 2,000 inmates in there. Someone's going to kill you, you know. So even though I was beat up pretty darn good, they did keep me safe from, from the other inmates that were riding.
Right. And so, you know, as they were holding you hostage, going on throughout the rest of the institution was even more fires than had been burning the night before, destroying all kinds of buildings and property. And, you know, we had staff trying to, in other places, were also being held hostage or trapped as well. And the state police coming, and finally there was an assault to actually free everybody. And I just talked with a trooper who actually, his platoon led the assault on K Block. So when things were coming to an end, where were you in the end, still a hostage?
I was in E Block.
E Block.
So I was in the bar. I was in the barbershop cell of E Block, and if I'm correct, I would have been the first hostage released.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure about that. At least the news wasn't ready when I rolled out.
And yeah. What was that process like, being released as a hostage? So, you know, explain to me how that happened.
Cool. I knew something would have to happen with it getting closer to morning, and that was probably the scariest point in time.
I'm sorry.
I'm actually shocked that I am this emotional, but that's fine. studies show that when hostages are being rescued, that tends to be most of the time when they die.
Oh.
And which sucks.
Well, yeah.
So whenever they did the assault on the block, basically the inmates went out thinking, I guess, it was just going to be a fight, and there were some shots fired right outside the block doors, and then the inmates all ran back in and went toward the rear of the block, and it was at that point where I realized that I was alone in my cell, and so I reached up and I pulled my blindfold off and the bag off my head, and I could see they were shutting the door, and they put the key in the door to lock it. Mm-hmm. And it's like, fuck, man, like, sorry for the swearing.
That's okay.
But I don't want to be locked in here with these guys. And that's when I bolted and hit the door before they locked it, and ran into the state police team right on the other side of the door.
Oh, wow. I think I may have seen that.
Yeah, I'm sure you have. I've seen the video. I saw the video that decades ago now. But
right.
I'm that guy.
Yeah, and then so what? They passed you off and sent you where? Where'd you go after that?
Well, at that point, they shoved a shotgun in my gut, which was totally understandable. And one of my coworkers happened to be with the team. Close by, and he recognized me as a hostage.
Mm.
And they basically, he walked me out to the main gate, and they sent me to the local hospital there. I forget the name of that.
Holy Spirit.
That's it.
Wow. So, were you hospitalized then?
I think they kept me overnight. I took a whole bunch of x-rays and, identified any wounds, so on and so forth. But I think I went home the next day and just enjoyed PSD for a while after that.
Mm. How long were you off And did you go back?
Never went back. Yeah, I was basically in, whatever you want to call it, treatment and recovery for a couple of years before, we all walked away from each other, that kind of thing.
So I asked some of the other people, like, how did the trauma show itself to them? And, you know, a lot of them weren't hostages like you were. I imagine that the nightmares must have been pretty bad for a while after.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Night terrors, night sweats, all that good stuff. I didn't like the sound of helicopters, chainsaws, or anybody dressed in brown clothing for quite a while.
Oh, yeah.
All the usual triggers, and managed to take care of all that over time.
Right. Wow. So tell me, how did you end up from that scenario to Australia, and what are you doing in Australia now?
Wow. what an awesome question, and it's a very fascinating story. Long story short, when I had PTSD, there were a couple approaches that I took to healing myself. One was diving into neurolinguistic programming, which was being, advertised a lot by Tony Robbins at that point in time. Since I wasn't sleeping and living on Budweiser, I saw Tony on the late night videos and, dove deep into NLP at that point. Another thing that I got into was Native American survival skills, because I figured the first thing I wanted to do was unscramble my brain, and the second thing I wanted to do was be left alone. And I figured if I learned how to live in the woods, nobody could bother me. So
right.
That was the plan. The cool thing that emerged from both of those was the people that I was learning the Native American survival skills from, they also taught the old philosophies. And the old philosophies... the old Native American philosophies really are fascinating, grounding, and healing. And that combined with neurolinguistic programming, it basically became my career. I started putting out products having to deal with spirituality and self-help and all sorts of, like, my weird-ass approach to stuff like that on the internet. And one day, I'm essentially lazy. I'm a very lazy human being, or effective, I don't know which. But I was reading about how important it was to have market research, and I'm not really big on market research. So I put up a little ad, and the ad was something like, for $50, I'll make a custom self-help recording for you. You send me an email, I'll send you one back, I'll send you an email, you send me one back, and from those little couple discussions, I'll make a custom recording for you. And the fellow in Australia ordered one, and he was a Forex trader, and he shared it with his friend, and his friend ordered one, and then they shared their recordings with a group of Forex traders, and they all ordered one, and one of them became a coaching client, then another one. So we're doing Skype coaching, sort of like what we're doing now, like talking on the internet. And long story short, they said, hey, how about if we fly you down here and you do a training with us? And I said, sure. So they flew me down, I did a training, and I met my wife. And from there, I began the immigration process down here. Now, what's really cool, and I just love the way that weirdness and synchronicities, or whatever you want to call them, show up. It was October 26th, 1989, when I went to work at Camp Hill. Had that incident happen, it that totally changed my life. It was October 26th, 2010, when I flew down here to Australia, which essentially was a prison island. As you know, they sent prisoners here. So it was the same day, just a few decades later, that I flew down here and met my wife and started all over again. So, yeah, cool, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Wow. amazing. So some of the things I ask individuals that were trapped or that were hostages is, wow, how did you get through it when you were in the middle of it?
I imagined the kids in my life.
Mm-hmm.
So it was sort of like that whole thing where, like how they teach Vietnam, like they taught Vietnam prisoners of war different imaginal techniques to get through the day. Mm-hmm. I imagined having kids in my life. I didn't have kids.
Because you were relatively young. How old were you when you were going through this?
23.
Okay, 23. So you didn't have your own kids, but you imagined that you did.
Yeah, I imagined having kids, mm-hmm. and that was the big thing. I just experienced what would it be like if I had kids, the adventures that I'd take them on, the places I would go, that kind of thing. Just something that that implied that I survived the night.
Right.
And God, it was cool. Yeah.
Did you have any training about that? Like, how did you know to do that?
I'd always been like a quote-unquote positive thinker kind of guy, always into self-help psychology. Read a little bit about a fellow named Neville Goddard who taught this kind of thing as well. And what was really cool, I'd taken my first NLP course when I was a police officer back in 1987-88. And so when everything happened, it's just when I just noticed, right, you know, yeah, these are the tools that I'll use to get through the night, and I have to dive deeper into this stuff to heal what's left over, essentially.
Wow. If you could give advice to anybody who would find themselves in a similar situation, what kind of advice would you give to those people?
Establish honest rapport. And when I say that, like, I mean, there's a lot of courses out there on establishing rapport, different tricks to do and stuff like that. But when the inmates that had me hostage had me hostage, I related to them as a human being. And, like, yeah, they'd be talking amongst themselves. I'd engage them in a little bit of conversation. And it can be very simple. Something like, you know, I bet in a way you guys are scared. I would be too. Just being honest and telling them I am scared. You know, like we all don't know how this is going to play. And just the little bits of conversation allowed me to connect with them as human beings. And like I said, it was probably 3 a.m. They cooked me a steak, and or they cooked me some kind of meat. Yeah, let me back up there. I didn't need it, but it was probably about 2:30 a.m. where I told them I'm hungry. And they actually cooked me a meal, and I thought, well, eating this may or may not be a good decision. But taking the time to honestly connect with them, because in hostage situations, there's what's called the Stockholm Syndrome.
Yes.
And it's basically where the hostage takes on the belief system of the captors.
Mm-hmm.
I approached it from, I'm going to invite them into my world. Because I'm wearing a uniform, they're wearing an inmate uniform. We're on opposite sides of the equation in some ways, but the common role that we all have is to survive the night. They don't want to die in the morning. I don't want to die during the night.
Mm.
And just really taking the time to go, right, you know, Stockholm Syndrome can work both ways. I'm going to be a decent, honest human being with these guys. And go from there. And the other part of the coin there, when I was guarding the inmate in the hospital, I was not a knucklehead with him. And yeah, I mean, he's in the hospital. Yeah, I'm in the hospital with him. Like, and I remember just telling him, look, let's just make it through the night. Right? I don't know why I think if they did a arterial ABG on him, so he must have taken him for smoke inhalation. So we're in the hospital, and I just carried on a conversation with the guy. You know, when I was a hostage, the guy was back in the prison, and they actually brought him in. And when they took my bag off, and the guy said, "Yeah, that's him. He's all right."
Mm.
And it's like, and it's those little things. Like, obviously, as a CO, you can't, you know, become quote unquote best friends with the inmates, but you can definitely. The motto, at least when I was there, was care, custody, and control. You can honestly care. And I think that goes a long way.
Wow. Well, I'll tell you what, my hat's off to you, because you sound, you know, like you got your act together and that you're happy and you're positive, and that's great, because there could be some people who would just suffer. And I'm glad to see that you took the steps needed to just change your life and make it as best as you possibly can. That's wonderful.
Yeah, you know, my entire life at this point is devoted to that. There's a little phrase that shows up in my work a lot. It's more play time and more playmates. And I get the reason why people end up becoming quote-unquote bad guys is they took something too serious. When life gets too serious and we get bogged down in, you know, weird belief systems, weird pursuits, doing things that we end up chasing happiness, and that just becomes a problem, versus learning how to enjoy your day, learning how to appreciate the gift that we are, the gift of life. And we really get to, quote-unquote, stop and smell the roses. So many people don't do that. They work 40 hours a week. They spend 2 hours a day on the road. They never take the time to really appreciate life. And
so is it fair to say that this event helped you to realize that? I mean, it's awful to think that being a hostage helped you with anything.
Well, yeah, I mentioned my email address, 2020@xhostage.com. That's important to me. I actually was able to buy that domain name back when you could buy domain names like that. You can't get a good one like that anymore.
Right.
And really, this whole thing of ex-hostage, it's not ex-hostage to the Camp Hill prison riots, even though that's part of it, but it's not being hostage to trading time for dollars, not being hostage to belief systems that keep you chasing happiness instead of enjoying life. Mm. And that to me really is what it's all about. When you've flown on an airplane before, right?
Yes.
What's the question? When you sit down and somebody starts talking to you, what's the number one question they always ask? They always ask, what do you do?
Uh-huh.
Everybody asks that question. When I came to Australia, I spent like a year getting on and off of airplanes, right? And every time I flew someplace, hey, what do you do? And people aren't really interested in your job. They could care less. But it's almost biological. We want to know, how do you serve?
Mm.
What do you give to the world? And the number one thing that I took from the Camp Hill prison riots was, what am I here to give? What's my core value to the world? And as a part of that incident, I mean, I can very authoritatively say, look, your life is up to you. And that incident really helped me get, you know, I mean, I could drink beer for the rest of my life and stay drunk. I could get on pharmaceuticals and have that manage my life. I don't want to be a manager. I don't want to have a life that needs managing. I choose to have a life that gets lived.
Mm-hmm.
And literally that incident, it was something that took me literally from being like that positive thinker guy that I talked about to somebody that just wants to get the message out. Look, you came here to live. You came here to give in some way. Find out what that is. If you do that, the adventure that you'll go on is amazing.
Mm. Well, Mr. 2020, I want to thank you very much for participating in this, and it's a very inspiring story. I thank you so much.
Oh, you're quite welcome. I got to tell you, I'm so appreciative that you reached out, because years ago I imagined something like this would come out of that incident, because, yeah, not only for the Department of Corrections, but for people in general, because in the event that there's ever something like that again, which I'm sure there will be, people need to know healing's possible, that actually getting on with your life is possible, and I thank you for the opportunity to share.
Thank you.